from here, we're going to get into some particularly scriptural arguments. We're kind of coming up on the closing case of the classical apologetic approach. So we'll deal with prophecy in the Bible, and then we'll deal with the resurrection of Christ, which is really one of my favorites, and in my view, perhaps the classical apologetics of the Bible itself. The Bible seems to put great weight on the resurrection, on his post-resurrection appearances as evidence for the resurrection, as the fact that there were a great number of witnesses, the fact that it's so well attested. So we'll be looking at that as well. But so that's kind of a jumping off point, sort of a transitional point from classical to presuppositional apologetics, in my view. And so I thought this would be good to take some time and review and start taking a little bit of practice to see how we would make these arguments. How is this going to work out in real life? And so we're going to be reviewing back today over some of the things that we've previously looked at. I tried to import some of the familiar slides that you've seen already. I don't know why they didn't work out quite like I was hoping, but that's all right. In any case, the data is still there. I think it just changed the format somehow. And so let's dive right in and talk about some ways that we can actually make these arguments in real life. So let's review back and think back early to our classes. Think about what is apologetics. You meet somebody, a Christian, and he says, "Oh, you're doing a Sunday school in apologetics? Yeah, I don't think you have to apologize for the Christian faith." Thank you very much. Yeah. You want to say, okay, well, that's true. You don't. But is he making an argument against apologetics? No, he's not. What is apologetics? Okay, in apologetics, you're making a defense of the faith. In making a defense, you're doing a couple things. One of those important things is you're providing information. Sometimes people have a real argument against the Christian faith. Sometimes they just have a point of ignorance, and you have to help explain something that they don't understand correctly. We've looked at a lot of that. So we're not simply trying to make arguments. Sometimes we just have to know what we're talking about so that we can provide better information than the information that they have. We've seen that a lot. All right, good. So let's think back now to an early class. We looked at the cosmological argument. And say you want to take a cosmological approach. And I'll give you a hint, a good way to do this. So I'll kind of give you a hint, and then you think of a good argument that you could make that would kind of address that point. Let's say I'm going to say, listen, I think that the matter, I believe that the universe started, there's no God necessary to start the universe, because the universe started with the Big Bang. The material, the material from the Big Bang, it's like it was all gathered into a small, all the matter in the universe was gathered into this small little kind of grapefruit size thing, or maybe small. It was infinitely dense, and it was that way for all time, for all infinity. And then it exploded. We call that the Big Bang. Now, thinking back to our Kalam argument, how could you address that? I'll give you some hints here. Okay, where did the ball come from? It always was. People feel very proud when they say that. It always was. Now we're kind of getting into the realm of religion, aren't we? It's always great to point out, remember, everybody has a religion. And again, this is presuppositionalism sneaking through, but one of your tasks as an apologist is to try to figure out what their religion is saying. Oh, the ball of stuff, it always was. Well, that's interesting. Why do you believe that? Alexi. An infinitely dense gas. Yay. Here's another hint here. Actual infinity. You remember this? What could you say about this? You say, oh, the grapefruit, the great mass of all things, grapefruit, it always was. And is and will be forever. Amen. Amen. What could you say about this? Daniel, what do you think? Actual infinities.
Why didn't it explode sooner?
Okay, yeah, good. Remember the train? You're standing at the train tracks waiting for the train to come in. The train tracks go infinitely down that way. And a train is placed at the very beginning. How long will it take to get to you? It will never get to you. In fact, it will never reach beyond the starting point if there's an infinite amount of train tracks. Because if you remember some of this, remember this? You got a CD with an infinite number of songs. And here you have an infinite number of CDs, and each one of those infinite number of CDs has an infinite number of songs on it. Which one, where do you find more music? Here or here? Neither one. It's all the same. You have an infinite number in both, because infinite is infinite. It goes on forever and ever and ever. So you can't actually have an actual infinite in the physical world, in the physical universe.
What about numbers, though? Because they do go in both directions forever.
Okay, they do. They do conceptually, but they don't. I said you can't have an actual infinity in the physical world. So if you could write them all down, then you would disprove that. But they're not written down. They're merely conceptual. So we can talk about God being infinite, even though, because God is spirit, not physical reality. So what if you started counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you did that right through the resurrection, you spend all the rest of eternity counting forever. Would you ever have an actual infinite? You'd never have an actual infinite. Actual infinite is the completed set of infinity. It's everything all together. This is a bizarre concept even to think about. A potential infinite is... Give me an example of a potential infinite. Good, yeah, you. You are potentially infinite. God is actually infinite. He has completed the work of being infinite. Whatever that means. You were potentially infinite. You had a beginning. You're created, just like the universe, and you will go on forever. Okay? So when somebody wants to talk about... So they say, the stuff for the Big Bang, it was always there. Well, now you're talking Bizarroville. Now you're talking... And if it's any consolation, theoretical physicists, the people who talk about this stuff, they get into bizarre stuff all the time, and they know it. It really morphs into a realm of philosophy. I mentioned that Roy Martin was studying advanced mathematics, and math, math seems like this is concrete, this is plain. But as Roy will tell you, once you get into really advanced, theoretical mathematics, it's all theory. Everything you've been taught kind of breaks down. They say, well, we don't really know that the concept of addition holds true for everyone. It's a theory, but we don't actually have proof that my one is your one. Now, I'm simplifying. Roy could give you a better explanation, but the things that you consider to be very simple and assumed are not even assumed when you get to this level, because they're trying to make sense of this. But what's the problem in trying to make sense of this? What's that? Well, not just that they're same, but trying to make sense of this, the problem is it doesn't make sense. You need God to make sense of the whole concept of an actual infinity. And so then the ball of stuff, the Big Bang, had to have a beginning. Remember, we used this Pepsi ad to a can with an infinite amount of Pepsi and an infinite amount of boxes with those same cans, same amount of Pepsi. And there's our train. And that's how physicists look at it. Remember this? The bounce theory of the world. Sir, there seems to be a large object in the path of our... There's a giant reset button at the end of the rocket ship. Boom, it resets. Evolution takes place. Eventually, they build rocket ships, and they get out there once again. All right, so moving ahead, let's think about the teleological principle. We talked about the anthropic principle. And does anybody remember the anthropic principle or the fine-tuning argument? What kind of conditions are necessary for life on Earth? Okay, you got to have water, and you have to have not just water, but you have to have liquid water, right? You can't just have ice. You can't just have gas. So it's got to be the right elements, or the right molecules, I should say, the right temperature, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? You've got to have all kinds of things. You have to have shielding from solar radiation. Otherwise, nothing could survive. So you have to have all of this, and sure enough, we here on lucky planet Earth, we happen to have it all. And what about the universe itself? What happens if a proton weighs respectively more than it does? What would happen if electrons had the same force, but protons had a slightly stronger force?
Matter would not exist.
Why is that, Joe? Explain it.
Because the atoms would be able to together.
Okay, good. What keeps the... Remember, you got two positive magnets, right? And what happens when you put them together? They go whoop, whoop, right? That, you know, everybody likes playing with those strong magnets because they kind of repel one another. It's kind of neat. So what holds the nucleus of any atom together is that you've got all these electrons spinning around outside of it, and they're all they're moving so fast they keep it all in. It's kind of like if you had a bunch of kittens in a little on a blanket on the lawn, and you're trying, and so the kittens are like the protons, they're trying to spread out, and your kids are like the electrons going around putting them back in the middle, keeping them all together, right? It's a crude example, but it works. So what happens if you make the kittens faster? Kittens get away. What happens if you make the kids slower? Kittens get away. What happens if you slow the kids down a little bit? Kittens get away, right? You have to have just the right circumstances. But what happens if the kids are too strong? Kittens get squashed, right? What happens if the kids are too fast? Well, the kittens never move anywhere, and they get malnourished. Whatever is going to happen to kittens. So we have to have a very, very narrow set of criteria under which the universe itself, not just the universe as we know it could exist, but any universe could exist. That you could have a universe that itself has matter. If you remember these, ratio of protons to electrons, entropy level of the universe, velocity of light, uniformity of radiation, distance between stars, 35 different parameters simply for the universe. That's not including planet Earth. For those that might say, well, maybe you could have, you know, acetone-based life or silica-based life. Okay, fair enough. If you want the universe to hold together, now, what are we then making a case for? Somebody says, why should I believe in God? How can you use this to make a case for the existence of at least a God? Right, it's so far beyond nil. Yeah, it's crazy. It's statistically the universe. According to scientists, the universe that we live in is statistically impossible. So now, turn this into an argument. How can you use this as an argument for the existence of God? Let me give you an example. Let's say a guy goes into a casino and he goes to the poker table and they deal him a royal straight flush. And he wins. First time, doesn't have to exchange any cards. And then they proceed to deal him 12 more royal straight flushes right in a row. Now, what does the wise gambling, what do they call them? The guys who oversee that. There's a special term, I can't remember what it is. I'm not a gambler myself. Pit boss. What does the wise pit boss do? Yeah, he shuts it down, kicks the guy out. Congratulations, sir, what a string of luck. The odds of getting a royal straight flush are like 1 in 300,000. You did it 12 times in a row. The odds of getting 12 royal straight flushes in a row are very, very, very good compared to the odds of having the universe in which we exist. In fact, they're phenomenally good in comparison. So, what does the wise pit boss do? He shuts it down. Why does he shut it down? What's that?
So they don't lose more money.
But is that fair of him to shut it down?
No, it's because he believes
they're cheating. Yeah, he shuts it down because he thinks the guy is cheating. And in fact, if he gets 12 royal straight flushes right in a row, is he cheating?
Yeah.
Of course he's cheating. Yes, nobody does it. It's statistically impossible. And yet, they all want to tell us, no, 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 but we do happen to live in a statistically impossible universe. Now, if you just randomly get dealt a royal straight flush, that's possible. That happens. One out of every 300,000 poker deals, they tell us. 12 in a row? No, not going to happen. If you were going to get 12 in a row, it would take the imposition of a mind to manipulate the situation in front of you, right? So how is this turning into an argument for the existence of God?
There has to be a mind.
There has to be a mind. There has to be a creative force behind odds like this. You cannot expect me to believe that this is just random. This is one of the better arguments because it's one that scientists themselves agree to. They say, yes, we know this is a huge problem for us. And so they've invented the multiverse theory, which states that all possibilities are happening all at once. And it's founded on faith. It takes, I mean, even scientists say, well, this is kind of a faith-based exercise, if they're being honest. So I think this is one of the the one that Christopher Hitchens cited as the most convincing theistic argument, as far as he was concerned. This is the one that he said, "Well, this is a tough one to deal with." He has faith, that they're going to find a solution to it. He had faith. He doesn't anymore. That they're going to find a solution to it, but he acknowledged this is a problem. So is it likely that somebody's going to say, you know what, 35 and all, well, sign me up for church? Probably not. The world's a funny place. Probably not. But you're able to help sow seeds of doubt in the faith that they already hold so dearly. And eventually, at the end of all of it, hopefully they're joining Annie Lennox and saying, take me to church. Information theory. Do you remember what this is all about? Yeah, good. Okay. The information that we're sharing here, Anna, your brain told your lungs to work and your vocal cords shaped sound, and that sound came in waves through to my ear, and I heard it. Now, where was the information located? Right. The information is located in your brain and my brain and everybody else's brain, we hope, or for the most part. And we have a series of symbols by which we're able to transmit and convey through those symbols the information that's in your brain, and it can make it over to my brain. This is really a remarkable thing. And so information, to be meaningful, must have a mind behind it. DNA is meaningful information, and so where's the mind behind it? If somebody says, there is no mind, it's not meaningful information. What do you say to that? DNA is not meaningful. Go ahead, Dave. Okay, life is pretty meaningful. If you don't have DNA, you don't have life. So do we want to say life has no meaning? Maybe they want to go there. Go ahead. Necessary but not meaningful. I think then we could challenge necessary for what? Necessary for what makes life necessary. So it's, you could say maybe it's a function. They might say, well, it's just a function of life. It's just how it works. But I think the greater point to drive at is that you're saying that life has no meaning at all. And most people don't want to say it. And maybe you find a nihilist and they say, nope, no meaning at all. Maybe move on to another argument. I don't know. This one isn't foolproof. So there's our DNA. We also looked at irreducible complexity. Anybody remember this? Tell us about, go ahead, Josh. Good. At a certain point, particularly on a molecular level, it's not such a good evolutionary argument, in my opinion. You might say, the woodpecker is a well-known argument in that case. They say, well, what good is a woodpecker if it's got, because a woodpecker is a really amazing creature, and it certainly is. It's got this long tongue, broop, which wraps up in its head, and it has shock absorbers on its brain. Because, as you can imagine, bashing your head against wood all day would tend to cause some pretty serious brain damage if you weren't careful about that. But they have these natural shock absorbers, so their brains aren't damaged. But then the argument goes, and woodpeckers also, unlike most birds, they have two talons in front and two in the back, and that allows them to hold on to the side of a tree and have a good grip. Because otherwise they'd go and they'd fall backwards. Well, what if they only had one in the back? They say, see, if you don't have the whole package, you don't have anything. None of it works. Well, let's say a woodpecker didn't have those two back talons on its feet. What would it do? Probably land on top of branches. Right? That could still be helpful to the woodpecker. Or maybe he couldn't peck so much. Maybe he'd just have to just do a little bit at a time. I don't know. So there's other ways that a woodpecker's long tongue could be used, minus the talons. At a molecular level, it starts to break down. A flagellum on a bacteria, and we're not going to get into it, but if you take out any one of those things, rods, pistons, and whatnot, it's pretty remarkable. Remember, when we invented wheels and automobiles and stuff, we didn't, well, at least wheels and axles, nobody knew about any of this. Turns out they exist on a molecular level. Take out one of those things, and we don't have any evidence there's any purpose for any of it apart from the whole package. In some cases, I'm sure they can come up with a plausible argument, but not in every. And so then it depends on faith. Well, our priests in the long white lab coats, they tell us that they just haven't found the right argument yet. They haven't found it, but I have faith. It's out there. So remember, it's never wrong, and at least give them credit for that. It's never wrong to say, boy, you know, I don't know the answer to your question. I'll try to find out. Maybe I won't be able to find out. Maybe there are things. They say, how can God be three and also one? One God and three persons? Impossible. Well, look, I don't understand it either. But I would argue that the realm of mystery, of paradox, applies in a much greater way to the spiritual realm than to the physical realm. And furthermore, if somebody wants to take a scientific worldview on things, then you have to provide your evidence scientifically. We don't have any, there's no such thing as a paradox in the physical world. It doesn't exist. Paradoxes are conceptual problems. They're spiritual problems, not physical problems. There's no such thing as a rock that's too big for someone infinitely strong to move. Right? That just doesn't exist. We talked about objective morality. This is, I think, one of the best arguments or discussions you can have with a non-Christian friend about where do your morals come from? What is your moral standard? They say, well, I just think you should be good to people. Go ahead, reply to that. What do you think? I just think you should be good to people. Okay, yeah, I think I shouldn't. Well, you don't want to be good to people? Oh, well, okay. Well, you should. Yeah, why? Why should I? Well, because it's, don't you want people to be good to you? You could say, no, I don't, or yeah, I do. I just don't want to be good to them. That's the big catch, right? If I can, that's called gaming the system. If I can get everybody else to believe they should be good to me, but I don't have to be good to them, game over, I win. Right? Why should I be good? It just makes the world a better place. Yeah. Good. Yeah, how are we going to know what is good? They say, well, I just don't think there's such a thing as objective morality. I just don't. Maybe you find it helpful, but I just don't think that it exists. What do you say about that? Remember this with the teapot, Francis Schaeffer and the teapot? He has a pot of boiling water, and he's holding it over the kid who says, I just don't think that there is such a thing as objective morality. And so he acts as if he's going to pour it on his head and says, I don't think there's such a thing as objective morality. It's tough to live in that universe, isn't it? So you think slavery is wrong? I think slavery was helping people out of their savagery into a civilized nation. What inherently is wrong with my position? Well, that has to be separate. There, ultimately, I think that we all believe in an objective morality. It's hard to get to. Larry, go ahead. Yeah, it's few and far between, but the Charles Mansons of this world are the people who escape this routine.
But right now we have evidence of this billionaire that is abusing young children on a consistent, systematic basis. He takes rich people, some of our own governors, some of our own high leaders go down and just pal around with him. Do you think they believe in objective morality?
Right.
They have no objective morality. There is no objective morality without the Lord Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. If you dig, I think if you dig deep enough, you'll find it with them. They'll, sure, yeah. But even then, the fact that they hold an objective morality as it relates to themselves, exploit that fact in your discussion. They hold to it at some level. So it's kind of an all or nothing thing. Either there must be objective morality or there's not. And you can do whatever you want. And the only concern is whether or not you can get away with it. If there's no inherent right or wrong. Go ahead, Taylor.
Sometimes they'll appeal to the Old Testament God being capricious. And how can we accept him as our moral standard when he's telling them to dash the babies against the rocks?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're making a case for a cultural relativism. So what's the problem with a cultural relativism? And think of, yeah, go ahead, Larry.
The problem with cultural relativism is that it invariably flows from what is most powerful.
That's right. Right.
And so they can't make what is just powerful, so they make what is powerful just.
Good, very good. Well said. Yeah, we get together. Yeah, you quoted him. We'll give you credit. We get together as a community, as a society, and we decide what is right and wrong. And we have all decided that the Jews need to go. We've got some camps set up for them, and that's where we're going to send them. If you want to hold to cultural relativism, then the man who protects the Jews is actually being immoral. He's actually defying his community's standards of what is good. He's the immoral man. Think of some other great immoral people throughout history. The Underground Railroad. Yeah. Blasphemers against their society's standards. They were immoral people, stealing other people's property and whatnot. Right.
In that
would make us immoral. Or let's say that we come to find out the majority of Americans oppose abortion, so now abortion is immoral. Isn't that convenient? Other famous immoral people. Anybody who's broken a color barrier, immoral. It was wrong of them. Their community did not condone Rosa Parks sitting in the front of the bus. She violated that community standard. Immoral. Well, what if somebody says, well, no, eventually you can be vindicated in your morality. So you know, it's true at the time, Rosa Parks, they thought she was being immoral, but as we look back on her, we realize now that she was in fact being moral. What's the problem with that? It renders everything at present day meaningless. Let me give you a good example of this, okay? We live in a society that is affected by Christianity enough that we protect the weak. And so people born with various disabilities are actually protected in our society. Our government actually provides money so they can have medical care that they need. We have things like the Special Olympics, right? Who hates the Special Olympics, right? Everybody loves the Special Olympics. And yet you have ethicists like the Australian Peter Senger who says that not only should it be acceptable to abort a disabled baby, it should also be acceptable to have a post-birth abortion. Which means, oh, we found out that our baby is born and has some kind of retardation or disability. We're going to kill him. This is an ethicist making these arguments. And these arguments now, as we embrace more and more, as the Western world embraces a culture of death, people are starting to buy into this right now. So then, perhaps the person who took their newborn child and killed that child because they had a disability, perhaps that's tomorrow's moral hero. Or what if they're not disabled? What if they're just worried about overpopulation? What if, you know, boy, this planet is just hurting so much. Maybe tomorrow's moral hero is today's mass murderer. Ridding the planet, he was sure only to kill people who drove SUVs. Think of how many carbon units he saved. And he planted trees on the weekend. There's no way to know what today's morality is. You see, the unbelieving, a world apart from God, God anchors the world, he holds the universe together. A world without a God anchoring it together is a world that just cannot hold together. The center cannot hold. It gyres and gimbals about. Without God to hold it all together, the world eventually falls apart, right? And so the thing that you want to be doing, we didn't even get to half of these that we're gonna have to stop now. But the thing that you're going to think of is you want to have good arguments that you're able to make. You want to be able to provide information. We didn't even get into the New Testament and New Testament arguments, the reliability of the New Testament. It's just information. Somebody says, don't you know your ESV Bible is a translation of 10 different translations before it? By the time you go from the Greek to the Latin to the French to the German to the English to the Hebrew and back to the English, there's no way to know what it says. That's just bad info. Your intel is wrong. It doesn't make any sense. You have to provide that info. But so you want to be thinking about that, but you also want to be looking for ways that their world that they're trying to describe, this godless universe they're trying to describe, is going to fall apart. Fortunately, there's a sense in which every non-believer is truly and actually religious, and there's a sense in which every non-Christian but religious person, Muslim, Buddhist, is really in a sense an atheist because they might believe in a God, but there is no God. There's no Allah who's listening to the prayers of Muslims. They're just shouting to the wind. There's nothing, no one hears, no one answers, no one cares what they say to Allah. And so there's a sense in which they're an atheist also. That wouldn't be the proper term, but you understand the sense. And so what we're going to find, and I hope somewhere down the road to be able to get to this, is that a universe apart from the triune God of Scripture ultimately cannot hold together. When you start looking at what Islam thinks Allah to be, an infinitely transcendent God about whom we have information? Doesn't make any sense. The inconsistencies within each one of these causes even those religions to fall apart. It's only in the Trinity that we can have, that we can make sense of. The Old Testament will tell us that we have a God who is transcendent and also near, but only the Trinity can make sense of that. So we'll wrap it up for today. I was hoping to get a lot further than we did, but I always make too many slides. So we're going to go to prayer.